somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 28, Writing on Human Skin, Enlightened Despotism Part 1, Russia. In November 2017, New York Times columnist Tom Friedman wrote a piece overflowing with praise of Saudi Arabia's young crown prince Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. MBS had granted Friedman an audience at one of the Saudi royal family's many opulent palaces. And Friedman was sold. I never thought I'd live long enough to write this sentence. The most significant reform process underway anywhere in the Middle East today is in Saudi Arabia. And he pointed to MBS as the driving force behind the top-down efforts to reshape the country. Someone had to do this job, wrench Saudi Arabia into the 21st century, and MBS stepped up. I, for one, am rooting for him to succeed in his reform efforts, he wrote. As proof of MBS's modernizing reforms, Friedman extolled an anti-corruption campaign, efforts to ease the strict and suffocating Wahhabist version of Islam, and the improvement of women's rights, including the right to drive, in a deeply misogynist state. Friedman did acknowledge that Saudi Arabia would have a very long way to go before it approached anything like Western standards for free speech and women's rights. But as someone who has been coming here for almost 30 years, it blew my mind to learn that you can hear Western classical music concerts in Riyadh now. And MBS told me it was just decided that women will be able to go to stadiums and attend soccer games.
Unfortunately, Friedman's column didn't exactly age well. In October 2018, the Saudi Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi went into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, never to return. After some transparently ludicrous attempts to twist the truth, Saudi Arabia had to admit that Khashoggi, a critic of the Saudi government, had been brutally killed and dismembered at the consulate. And according to intelligence services and a UN expert report, much evidence points to MBS as the mastermind. And that's not all. While women might be able to drive and attend soccer matches, advocating human rights and speaking to foreign journalists was not part of the MBS reform agenda. As Lujain al-Hadlul, Hatun al-Fassi, Iman al-Nafjan, and Asisa al-Yusef found out when these four women were arrested and tortured, allegedly under the supervision of one of MBS's close advisors. Friedman has since backtracked, and perhaps it will comfort him that his initial embrace of a supposedly progressive dictator mirrors the writings of some of Europe's leading 18th century intellectuals. Because many prominent Enlightenment thinkers hailed the enlightened despotism of absolute rulers committed to improving their societies based on rationalist and secular ideas that had gained traction in the Enlightened era. Philosophers like Voltaire, Montesquieu, and D'Alembert were showering praise on absolutist rulers like Peter the Great, Frederick the Great, and Catherine, also the Great, for their ambitious Enlightenment reforms and embrace of science and progress. But they often remained blind or indifferent to the fact that these rulers used authoritarian means to achieve their enlightened ends. Philosophers praised the liberty of conscience in Petersburg. D'Alembert claimed that Peter had liberated Russia from the yoke of barbarism. And in History of the Russian Empire under Peter the Great from 1759, Voltaire painted a sometimes cringeworthy portrait of the heroic Enlightenment Tsar Peter single-handedly dragging Russia across both time and space from the Dark Ages and Asia into the 18th century in Europe. But as we shall see, Peter and Catherine's rule was a tad bit more complicated than the groveling rose-tinted picture painted by Voltaire.
Last episode teased out major developments across Europe during the Enlightenment, with three key themes dominating: rationalist ideas, religious tolerance, and the secularization of censorship. The progress of Enlightenment ideals also caught on with several European monarchs. Although it was an uneasy embrace, since the erosion of ecclesiastical authority and religious orthodoxy tended to undermine the legitimacy of absolute monarchs ruling by divine right or in close alliance with the established church. And the more radical Enlightenment ideals of republicanism or democracy were obviously a no-go. But fortunately for those rulers who wanted to enjoy the benefits of modern science, learning, and the fresh air of religious tolerance without sharing power with the people, many prominent Enlightenment thinkers shared their elitist outlook. Enlightenment values was for the elite, while old prejudices and superstition was necessary opium for the people. This included the very face of the Enlightenment, François-Marie Arouet, a.k.a. Voltaire, who rose to become perhaps the most famous man in Europe, equally loved, admired, feared, and hated for his witty and lacerating pen, which never lay idle. Voltaire is such a huge part of the Enlightenment, though his actions were far from always enlightened, that we'll cover him in more details in later episodes. But no one better embodied the attempt to replace the alliance between throne and altar with an alliance between throne and reason. So we have to spend a little time on Voltaire in this episode too. To understand the context which allowed a figure like Voltaire to emerge, we have to look at early 18th century France. As I've mentioned before, the death of Louis XIV in 1715 eased the harsh climate of religious intolerance and censorship, which had exiled Protestants and nonconformist ideas. The man behind this liberalization was Philip, the Duke of Orléans, who became regent of France, while Louis XV was too small to bear the weight of scepter and crown. Philip is said to have been an atheist who had the writings of Rabelais inserted into his Bible so he could pose as pious during Mass. The Duke did not abolish the multi-layered system of censorship, but enforcement became much more lax and massively increased the reach and penetration of the Dutch dark web with its subversive and impious ideas. In the words of one historian, Philip presided over an unprecedented transformation in the French book trade, publishing, reading habits, and indeed the French state of mind itself. Fissures also opened up within the Catholic Church in France. In 1713, Louis XIV had successfully lobbied the Pope to issue a bull condemning Jansenism, an increasingly popular branch of Catholicism that stressed divine grace and predestination, but which to Orthodox Catholics smelled suspiciously like Calvinism. Upon the death of Louis, Jansenist writings flooded France, creating a heated religious debate. Jansenists were by no means committed to principle tolerance, but all these events habituated France society to a wider degree of differences in both religious and secular ideas, which made the previous insistence on rigid conformity to orthodoxy in thought and literature fall out of favor. Although the red lines were still much more suffocating than in England or the Dutch Republic. It was in this new, exciting, and increasingly vibrant environment that Voltaire took the first steps towards his meteoric fame. He started out in 1716 by publicly identifying as a deist, which was pretty bold. But his acerbic pen soon stretched the new and more permissible limits of free speech beyond the breaking point. Because the new regent may have been more tolerant of free thinking and religious diversity, but his liberality did not extend to suffering insolent scribblings from lowly subjects. So when Voltaire twice satirized the colorful private life of the regent, who, it was rumored, was a little too fond of his own daughter, he was first banned from Paris and then imprisoned at the Bastille for almost a year. Despite these setbacks, Voltaire became a court poet and even obtained a royal stipend. But then, in 1725, he once again overplayed his pen, mocking a nobleman who had Voltaire severely beaten. When Voltaire demanded satisfaction, the nobleman engineered to have Voltaire sent back behind bars at the Bastille. This turn of events convinced Voltaire to leave for England, where he fell in everlasting love with the pragmatic English commitment to tolerance and freedom of the press, championed by thinkers like Locke, and which had allowed the genius of Newton to flourish. But once back in France, Voltaire got into trouble again in 1734 when he issued his Lettres Philosophiques. In fact, it was Voltaire's publishers who had gone ahead and released the book without an approval from the royal censor and without Voltaire's consent. Though Voltaire didn't think his brand of philosophy could be a threat to society, religion, or political order. As he put it, too few people read, and fewer still could read and think. But the book caused a scandal and was seen as a threat by the authorities. It was publicly burned by the royal hangman, and the printer was arrested and the stock of books confiscated. An arrest warrant was even issued, so Voltaire, who was not so keen on a third stint in the Bastille, was forced into exile for a second time, just across the border in Switzerland, from where, as we shall see in later episodes, Voltaire continued being sucked into, and sucking others into, controversy and scheming. Despite Voltaire's heavy-handed treatment at the hand of monarchs and aristocrats, he didn't turn into a radical who wanted to destroy monarchy and introduce democracy or overturn all tradition and basic structures of society. Voltaire was in favor of religious toleration and against superstition and fanaticism, but he was deeply opposed to atheism and Spinozism. He was in favor of freedom of speech, but thought that learning and debate should be the prerogative of the elite. It was, according to Voltaire, a great question up to what degree the people, that is 9/10 of the human race, must be treated as monkeys. And he thought that in most instances, a benevolent prince was much preferable to democracy, and therefore no philosopher should be in opposition to the rule of an enlightened despot. From 1736, he struck up a literary friendship with the future Prussian philosopher King Frederick the Great. In 1750, he even moved to Prussia to live with Frederick. Much more on that in the next episode. Voltaire also struck up a deep relationship with Catherine the Great, who was charmed by Voltaire's glossy portrait of Peter the Great. And Catherine became even more enamored with Voltaire when he threw himself into one of history's first human rights campaigns, securing the post-mortem acquittal of French Huguenot Jean Calas, who had been falsely accused, tortured, convicted, and executed for killing his own son in a trial marred by religious bigotry by the Catholic authorities handling the case. To Voltaire, the Calas case was a prime example of the religious fanaticism and obscurantist criminal law which he so detested. And Catherine was so moved by Voltaire's incessant PR campaign that she donated money to the Calas family and wrote to Voltaire, "You have combated the masked enemies of mankind, superstition, fanaticism, ignorance, intrigue, evil judges, and the abuse of power." With such sweet talk, how could Voltaire possibly resist the allure of enlightened despotism? The original enlightened despot was Peter the Great, who became Tsar in 1682 and ruled Russia for some 32 years, during which he basically tried to accomplish a modernization process that had taken his Western European role models 2 centuries and watershed events like the Renaissance and Reformation to develop. But if the rest of the country weren't willing to leave the Middle Ages and embrace the future voluntarily, Peter would march them towards modernity at the crack of a whip and the pointy end of his shiny German boots. Peter wanted enlightenment now. His motto could have been, "Move fast and break tradition." Peter's reign is perhaps best summed up in the words of the great Russian poet Alexander Pushkin. With an autocratic hand, he daringly sowed enlightenment. The so-called Petrine Revolution affected everything from the organization of government, the economy, army, navy, sciences, literature, arts, and the role of the powerful Orthodox Church. One of the main inspirations behind Peter's revolutionary zeal was his so-called Great Embassy, an 18-month tour of Europe, beginning in 1697, which brought Peter to places like the Dutch Republic and England, where the more modern era of science, technology, secular attitudes, and religious tolerance deeply appealed to the young Tsar. He viewed his native country as hopelessly backward, retarded by useless traditional values and superstition. Voltaire summed up the before and after of Peter's reign thusly. The Muscovites were less civilized than the Mexicans when they were discovered by Cortes. They were stagnating in ignorance in the absence of all the arts. But enter the new enlightened ruler and 30 centuries could not have accomplished what Peter did when he traveled for several years. There were, of course, limits to Peter's enlightenment project. He was not about to liberate the perhaps one-third of Russians eking out miserable lives as serfs, essentially slaves, chained to the properties of landlords. And Peter had absolutely no plans to involve the Russian people more broadly in power sharing or even deliberation. So Peter was not about to set free the pens and tongues of his people, though he did ease the harsh restrictions on religious minorities. Peter kicked off his modernizing reforms in 1700 with a fashion statement. From January 4th, 1700, all Russian towns and noblemen were required to shave and dress like Western Europeans, or pay a steep tax. Only priests and peasants were exempt. The contemporary French historian Jean-Roussé de Missy accounts how officials were stationed at the gates of the towns to collect that tax, which the Russians regarded as an enormous sin on the part of the Tsar and as a thing which tended to the abolition of their religion. The law was very unpopular with the Orthodox Church, which took facial hair very seriously and viewed the lack of a proper beard as blasphemous and heretical. But Peter wasn't bothered. He issued another decree, forcing Russian women out of their traditional garments and into tight French corsets, dresses, footwear, and hats. Mingling of the sexes at dances and banquets was also ordained. These laws are like the bizarro version of the Taliban. Instead of forcing men to grow beards or women to wear burqas to mirror 7th century religious ideals, Peter forced his people to dress, shave, and behave like Europeans in the name of modernity. When the Tsar grew up in the 1680s, printing was tightly controlled by the Orthodox Church. In the whole 17th century, only 10 non-religious titles were published from the printing press in Moscow. Books in foreign languages were banned out of fear of spreading heresy. Not that many would have read books. As late as 1797, it is estimated that less than 7% of the Russian population was literate. So rates were likely even lower a century before. Some historians talk of a print revolution under Peter. Because when he assumed power, one, yes, one printing press existed in Russia. This was increased to 6 at the end of his reign. And between 1700 and 1725, 100 times more printed non-fictional material was produced in Russia than in the whole of the previous century. Though that doesn't say a lot. In Boring and Van Santen's 2009 estimate over book production and consumption, which I mentioned in the last episode, Russia ranks rock bottom with no measurable book consumption until the second half of the 17th century, and then barely registering. As all institutions, these printing presses were under either governmental or religious control and had to serve the interest of the state and official policy. But in addition to Bible and liturgies, the press began churning out lexica, logarithmic tables, and governmental decrees. Peter even developed a new secular script. But still, religious literature accounted for 40% of the book supply, whereas fiction and plays and poetry only accounted for 0.2%. In 1702, Russia's first newspaper was born. It was simply called Vedomosti, sorry for the pronunciation, or the news, and its declared goal was to report about military and other affairs which need to be made known to the people of the Muscovite realm and the neighboring states. Needless to say, the paper was a tightly controlled government news channel with limited circulation. Think of it as Pravda 1.0. Because Peter only allowed printing presses tightly controlled by his own government or the church, there was no need for a pre-publication censorship regime. But people could still write in manuscript. So Peter issued an edict prohibiting monks from keeping ink and paper in their cells. They were only allowed to write under the watchful gaze of superiors. The law was expanded in 1718 to include all Russians. If you witness someone writing behind a locked door, you are obliged to report the offense or risk charges of sedition on pain of cruel corporal punishment. In addition to the tight controls on the means of publication and writing, there were also certain issues that Peter did not want any fresh light shining upon. When Peter visited London in 1698, he was horrified by the degree of free speech enjoyed by English lawyers and reportedly said, "I too have that ilk at home. I will hang them all as I get back." And when Peter's sweeping reforms were opposed by anonymous letters or pamphlets left in public places, he issued a flurry of edicts, including in 1715 an obligation to promptly and in front of witnesses burn such writings without having read them. But the most draconian restriction was the concept of slovo I delo, meaning the sovereign's word and deed, which basically meant that any unauthorized discussion of the Tsar's person or policies were potential acts of high treason, punishable by torture and death. An Austrian diplomat described Peter's increasing paranoia. "He began to have suspicions of everybody's loyalty. No day, holy or profane, were the inquisitors idle. Every day was deemed fit and lawful for torturing. No day were those that were left alive exempt from scourging or scorching, or else they were broken upon the wheel, or driven to the gibbet, or slain with the axe." People were tortured and executed for questioning the penal system, discussing Peter's new imperial title, and peddling prophecies. At the end of Peter's rule, the slovo I delo not only left a long and bloody trail of tortured and executed victims. The law became severely abused as a way to settle private scores and as an extortionist tactic. Even bums would threaten to denounce passers-by in the street unless they were given money for drinks. So it seems that pretty essential elements of Enlightenment ideals got lost in translation in Peter's memo on what is Enlightenment. And unlike Voltaire and many others who worship Peter, Montesquieu did suggest that perhaps he had gone a bit too far, whereas Ilvisius outright condemned Peter as a failure. But even if Peter was a thin-skinned and paranoid autocrat, there's no doubt his modernizing reforms also helped pave the way for some progress. Peter's attitude to religion was a careful mix between Western European-style tolerance he so admired and a real politic pragmatism. He himself had little interest in orthodox piety, which he openly mocked as a young man. But his tolerance was carefully tailored to serve his political goals. The official imperial policy was to tolerate believers of all faiths as long as they were loyal subjects, good taxpayers, and soldiers. And Peter welcomed Lutherans, Calvinists, and Huguenots into his administration and army, which brought new and enlightened ideas on religion and philosophy. He also allowed the establishment of new Lutheran, Reformed, and Catholic churches in his new capital, St. Petersburg, and a few other major cities. But there was a substantial but to Peter's toleration. Non-Orthodox churches were not allowed outside a select few cities, nor was he about to let Jews settle in Muscovy and create tensions with the Orthodox population. In the words of Alexander Gordon, a Scottish general in Peter's army, the Tsar had a great regard for learning and was at much pains to introduce it into the country. Before Peter, scholarship was more or less confined to a close circuit of monastic orders, with exceptions for technical skills directly serving state interests. Peter founded the Russian Academy of Science, though its role was to support the government, not to engage in liberal science. He also laid the foundation of Russia's first university, which opened in Moscow in 1755, and opened Russia's first public library and museum. Peter favored technical disciplines like mathematics, geography, medicine, and shipbuilding. He also gave Latin and modern foreign languages a facelift so they could help Russians learn Western science and philosophy. He even encouraged the introduction of pragmatic Enlightenment philosophers like Locke, Leibniz, Pufendorf, and Newton at his imperial court.
This was also reflected in the Tsar's personal library, containing some 1,663 titles. But needless to say, you didn't find Spinoza or Bale on his shelves. Other prominent nobles and officials built even more extensive libraries. But Peter was a pragmatist, not a philosopher, and certainly not a fan of radical free thinking. He actually instituted a system of inquisitors to keep an eye on the clergy and make sure they conform to his way of thinking. The enlightened circle of Russians was confined to a tiny minority around Peter's court, which meant that the secular and rationalist attitudes of Russia's governing elite moved further and further away from the rest of the population, who had no access to or interest in Enlightenment philosophy and Western European values. They were quite content with the old ways that had provided sustenance, meaning, social cohesion, and capital T truths for generations. The Orthodox Church was the biggest enemy of Peter's educational reforms. They feared the effect of Western ideas on Russian culture and that Latin was a Trojan horse allowing Catholicism to corrupt Orthodoxy. By jealously guarding education and culture, the Church effectively succeeded in eradicating classical literature, history, philosophy, and science from the Petrine reforms. Virtually no Latin or Greek texts were published, much less translated into Russian, before the 1760s. So how should we judge Peter's contribution to free speech? Historian Lindsay Hughes writes that despite the educational reforms and print revolution, controls from above and lack of initiative and expertise from below meant that a Russian free press was still in the distant future. But distant or not, Peter's reforms unwittingly helped fertilize the soil out of which the idea of freedom of expression would grow in Russia, though the seed planted by Peter's reforms would need four decades to blossom. And while spectacular when in full bloom, Russian free speech came with spiky thorns and proved too delicate to take root and prosper in a hostile environment. It was during the reign of Catherine II, or Catherine the Great, that freedom of speech blossomed in Russia. In 1765, the contemporary historian August Ludwig Schlözer wrote, "From this time there begins in Russia a new literary world which alone makes the reign of Catherine II epoch-making. Before that time the fear of publicity was unbelievably great and the fear of the printed word simply childish. Almost anything that had to do with the state was considered a state secret. But then Catherine II appeared. She defined the concept of state secret and legalized the enormous difference between treasonable spying and learned research." In his book on freedom of expression in 18th century Russia, the 20th century historian K.E. Papmil concurs and finds that "a very considerable liberalization in the field of freedom of expression became apparent in Russia in the first years of the new reign. It can be said that Catherine was the first ruler in Russian history who was conscious of the concept of freedom of expression and of its positive value." Perhaps you can call Catherine's reforms the first wave of perestroika. Catherine was born a German princess named Sophie, but moved to Russia as a teenager to marry the future Peter III. He assumed power in 1762 and actually strengthened religious freedom and abolished the Slovoy Delo law. But he was also an insufferable buffoon, alienating just about everybody. So Catherine had him deposed and likely killed too, although the details of his murder are murky. From the very get-go, Catherine was determined to push Russian culture and values further westwards than under Peter the Great. True, under Elizabeth I, there had been some liberalization and progress, and in the 1750s, new printing presses and the University of Moscow were established. But this did not signal a recognition of the principle of free speech. Catherine was steeped in Enlightenment ideals, and unlike Peter, who was mostly inspired by Dutch and German influences, Catherine was an enthusiastic correspondent with French philosophers like Voltaire, Diderot, and D'Alembert, whom she brainstormed with on how best to carry out her grand designs of progressive social engineering. And among the ideals she thought necessary for enlightenment
was freedom of expression. This is perhaps where someone more cynical should have told her that freedom of speech and autocracy are difficult value systems to reconcile, and once the genie is let out of the bottle, one will have to choose between them. But apparently Catherine was under the impression that she could unleash freedom of speech in the realm of ideas, philosophy, and culture while restricting its application from the sphere of politics and government. Because she certainly had no ambition about entertaining any ideas about popular sovereignty. As you can probably guess, Catherine was a liberal autocrat about to be mocked by reality. Not that there was a popular push for Enlightenment ideals in the general population. If anything, Catherine's liberal outlook was wildly out of touch with the still very traditionally minded general population of Russia, about half of which were peasants and a third serfs. I love this quote from Russian writer Mikhail Shishkin, who's writing about the early 19th century, which Catherine's reforms helped shape. Russia had a strange situation on its hands. One territory now contained two nations, completely different in spirit and culture, though they both were Russian and both spoke the same language. One part of the people, millions and millions strong, lived in the provinces, poor, uneducated, slowly drinking themselves to death, and mentally still residing in the Middle Ages. The other part was concentrated in the two Russian capitals. They were educated, well-off, well-traveled, and with a European understanding of the democratic organization of society. One of Catherine's first decisions was to offer Diderot to publish the French Encyclopédie at a time when it was still banned in France. Voltaire remarked to Diderot, "In what time do we live? France persecutes philosophers while Scythians offer them protection." Much more on that pivotal moment in free speech history in a later episode, by the way. Catherine also sponsored and endorsed the translation and publication of French books attacking both the absolute monarchy and serfdom in her own empire. Unthinkable under Peter, who probably would have tortured the translators himself. Catherine did draw the limit at foreign books that praised her late husband, meddled in foreign policy, and sometimes even edited manuscripts sent to her by authors and playwrights. In 1765, an Academy of Fine Arts was established. It had its own printing press for, quote, useful books, as well as a library, and was to facilitate open debate among the learned. Add to this the first state-sponsored secondary schools for girls in Europe. A few private associations were also allowed a wide autonomy rather than being under the direct government control. The number of annually published book titles tripled in the decade from 1761 to 1770 compared to the previous decade, and the increase in supply and demand resulted in the first private bookshops. Please don't mistake this for cheap whataboutery. But for traditionalist Russian nobles and the Orthodox Church, the influx and influence of Enlightenment writings must have been the equivalent of how people in modern Western democracies view Russian troll factories today. Because just like Russian trolls try to sow discord and division in order to undermine trust and belief in democratic institutions and liberal values, so Enlightenment ideas was a frontal assault on the deeply traditional values and hierarchical structures of authority which Russian society was built upon. To the philosopher, these values was nothing but a toxic mix of Asiatic barbarism and dark superstition imposed by a conspiracy between despotic monarchs and the obscurant clergy of the Orthodox Church in order to keep Russians ignorant and enslaved. But to most Russians, tradition and what the philosopher called superstition provided meaning and what we today would call social cohesion. Few Russians dreamt of a society based on the principle of reason over faith. But Catherine welcomed the Enlightenment troll factories, and in the true spirit of Voltaire, Catherine greatly expanded religious freedom in her realm. As she wrote,
"The human mind is irritated by persecution, but the permission to believe according to one's opinion softens even the most obdurate hearts."
The British ambassador actually thought that she was too mild for the rough nature of her subjects, who were all permitted the free exercise of their religion, whether Christian, pagan, or Mohammedan, every sect of which is now permitted. In fact, the ambassador concluded,
There's no country in the world where all religions are more freely tolerated than in Russia. This had real consequences, including for the rapidly increasing Muslim minority included in the empire due to military conquests. As late as 1738, a convert from Islam was burned to death after having been seduced to Mohammedan laws again. Such practices would end, and Catherine took active steps to accommodate the Muslim minority. Later in her rule, Catholics and Jews were even permitted to publish religious books. But the watershed moment for freedom of speech in Russia was Catherine's hugely ambitious idea to revise and codify a new law code in the so-called Great Commission of 1767 to 1768. Papmil describes it as
the first articulate statement of the principle of this aspect of freedom conceived as one of the civil liberties in the history of Russia.
The commission consisted of elected deputies from all classes, excluding serfs. More than 200 plenary sessions took place with debates on law and politics. There seems to be some disagreement among historians and contemporary observers as to how free the debates really were. Some claim that the delegates rarely uttered anything controversial and served as mouthpieces of the government line. Papmil, on the other hand, notes that Catherine ordered officials to remove any hateful restrictions of free speech and to ensure controversy so that the pros and contras of each section of the project be thoroughly and adequately debated. It may be that both sides are right. Imagine being a peasant asked to propose new laws when for all your life any criticism or even mentioning of the Tsar and Tsarist policies flirted with torture and execution. Not to mention the huge gulf in education, status and learning between yourself and the courtiers running the commission. That in itself must have induced self-censorship in the minds of many. Fortunately for those who held their tongues out of fear and awe, Catherine had set out her own views of the new principles to govern Russia in her Bolshoi Nakaz, or Great Instruction. It consisted of 22 chapters and 655 articles, but 294 of the articles were copy-pasted from Montesquieu's The Spirit of the Laws, and another 100 articles on criminal justice were lifted from Cesare Beccaria's seminal work of Crimes and Punishments. Enlightenment values for the win. Ever the court flatterer, Voltaire called the Great Instruction the century's most beautiful monument drafted by the Minerva of the North. So what principles did Catherine believe in? Well, for one, she conceived freedom as the natural right of man, although not an unconditional one. She also saw a direct connection between freedom of expression and the progress of learning and literature. She spent much ink on trying to distinguish between lèse majesté, insulting the Tsarina, and high treason. To Catherine, obscure accusations endangered the liberty of the citizen, and if the crime of high treason was laid down in vague and indefinite terms, an infinity of different abuses would arise. She then invoked the classical principle of distinguishing between words and deeds. Spoken words were always liable to differing interpretations and should only be punished as a capital offense if the specific treasonable words were expressly defined. This was so because words did not constitute the essence of the crime. So how could a capital crime such as high treason consist of words and be punished in the same manner as the very action itself? Catherine still thought that tarnishing the glory of the sovereign was beyond the pale, but the punishment should be mild. If you go back to episode 21, you'll realize that these considerations are copied, sometimes almost verbatim, from book 12 and especially chapter 12 on indiscreet speeches of Montesquieu's The Spirit of the Laws. But before you start thinking of Catherine as the Russian John Stuart Mill, let's muddy the waters and provide some nuance. Because the police were simultaneously given elaborate instructions to crack down on satirical writings that were libelous or created temptation to human morals or life, and not to allow any private comedies without prior approval so as not to offend chaste ears with rude words. Catherine also had no qualms about instructing the police to subject the lower classes to corporal punishments for rumor mongering. But the darkest exception to Catherine's free speech ideals was the utter contempt she showed for the serfs. In 1767, the very year she issued her liberal great instruction on Russia's new law code, she also issued a decree on serfs. This paints a much darker picture of the enlightened Tsarina, although it reiterates already existing laws. Serfs, the decree declared,
owe their landlords proper submission and absolute obedience in all matters. All persons who dare to incite serfs and peasants to disobey their landlords shall be arrested and taken to the nearest government office, there to be punished forthwith as disturbers of the public tranquility without leniency.
And Catherine had no time for serfs whining about their lot in life. So anyone petitioning the Tsarina with complaints about their landlords, as well as anyone writing up such a petition, was to be
punished by the knout and forthwith deported to Nershinsk to penal servitude for life.
No wonder Catherine had to battle serious peasant revolts. Contrast the appalling treatment of Russian serfs with Catherine's lavish treatment of foreign philosophes. When Diderot was in financial trouble, she offered to buy his library, leaving the books in the custody of Diderot's home until his death, and paying him a stipend as chief librarian of his own home. But the money came with strings attached. Diderot had to visit his patron in St. Petersburg. The Tsarina and the philosophe spent countless hours discussing ideas and philosophy. When Diderot kept pressing the case for more radical reforms, including the emancipation of serfs, Catherine absolutely owned him with a reply that I just can't let go and keep reading over and over.
I have listened with the greatest pleasure to the inspiration of your brilliant mind. But all your grand principle, which I understand very well, would do splendidly in books and very badly in practice. In all your plans for reform, you are forgetting the differences between our two positions. You work only on paper, which accepts anything, is smooth and flexible, and offers not obstacle either to your imagination or to your pen. While I, poor Empress, work on human skin, which is far more sensitive and touchy.
Boom! Take that, Monsieur Philosophe. It left Diderot demoralized, and he admitted to having smelled the odor of despotism and feeling naive for whitewashing the autocratic Tsarina. But the fact that Catherine was aware of the limits of enlightenment in a huge multi-ethnic, largely illiterate, and deeply traditionalist empire did not dampen her ambitions. At her initiative, new periodic and satirical journals were established in the 1770s. Though some censorship had been necessary to curb excesses and libels. Still, these journals catered to members of the small but growing class of intellectuals who had grown up with the Enlightenment ideals that Catherine had allowed to circulate in Russia for two decades. Particularly daring and independent-minded was the journalist, writer, and Freemason Nikolai Novikov. Novikov increasingly pushed the case for intellectual freedom extending to the political sphere. Political freedom was the only guarantor of civil liberties, including freedom of expression, without which learning cannot thrive. Novikov pointed to the example of freedom under the Roman Republic and the baseness of the slavery of the empire, and hailed England for its advances in philosophy, which was due to the proud liberty of thought and writing, which ought to be held as an example to the whole world. This came dangerously close to crossing the red lines of Catherine's tolerance, which only extended freedom of speech to the civil and not the political sphere, and consequently did not allow outright criticism of Tsarist rule, nor advocacy of more liberal alternatives. Initially, Catherine dropped her sponsorship of Novikov journals, but in 1784, she officially moved against Novikov based on some articles of his on the Jesuit order, which Catherine ordered stopped and confiscated. Mother was not mad, she was disappointed. But Novikov actually responded with a clarion call for free speech and warned against censorship that would kill freedom of thought quicker than anything else. Despite the budding and free-spirited intellectual scene and the unnerving presence of secretive Masonic lodges,
the Tsarina officially allowed for the establishment of private printing presses in 1783, provided they did not attack the government, Christianity, or common decency, and that the local police were informed and allowed to inspect books about to be published. But Russian police was not well versed in political theory or French philosophy, and rather than just censor everything, they let most new books pass, which meant that the government more or less lost control of print and publishing at a time where more radical Enlightenment ideas were germinating among intellectuals who were not content to bow and grovel submissively as had Voltaire and D'Alembert. And sure enough, the new means of public expression was eagerly seized upon by Novikov and his circle of Masonic friends. The Novikov circle established two official and one secret printing press, and in 1784, Novikov and a group of other Freemasons established an actual printing company with 20 printing presses. Apparently, Novikov did not get the memo that Catherine was less than happy with his independent assertion of an increasingly politically flavored justification and practice of free speech, especially when emanating from the secretive environment of Masonic lodges and societies, which Catherine was deeply suspicious of. So in 1785, Catherine cracked down with an anti-Masonic policy, including an edict which ordered the examination of existing books and severely beefed up pre-publication censorship of new publication by the private printing presses. There were to be no more schisms, nonsense, and all kinds of absurd interpretation. Oh, and Novikov himself was to be examined in the ins and outs of the Orthodox faith, which he seemed to have forgotten. And all Novikov books, not yet examined, were to be confiscated pending proper vetting. 461 titles were thus impounded, but once Novikov had passed his religious exam and the censors completed their review, only 6 Novikov books were permanently censored, while the rest were released. But Novikov and other publishers were also given a stern warning against publishing strange philosophies, or else have their works confiscated and lose the right to print, publish, and sell books in the future. Now Mother was both disappointed and mad. But just to be on the safe side, she also issued an edict prohibiting secular printing presses from publishing religious books pertaining to the Orthodox faith. Papmil sees this crackdown as aimed at Masonic tendencies rather than freedom of speech as such, though to me the difference seems rather academic. It should be said, however, that printing and book production did peak in the following years. If the combination of Freemasons, radical Enlightenment ideals, and printing presses made Catherine think twice about just how valuable freedom of speech really was, the French Revolution saw her reforms come to a screeching halt, and then she hit reverse. It didn't help that Catherine was also fighting several wars and had to put down a massive peasants' revolts in the previous decade, nor that her advisers were conservatives hostile to her liberal ideas. By far the most prominent victim of the new reactionary winds was the author Alexander Radishev, a nobleman who had encountered Enlightenment ideals, including Spinoza and Bale, while studying in Leipzig. He couldn't have picked a worse time to publish his controversial book, Journey from St. Petersburg to Moscow. It came out in the summer of 1790, less than a year after the revolution broke out in Paris. And despite being sold anonymously and being published on Radishev's own printing press, no publisher would touch it, it sold out immediately. The book is a powerful social critique of Russian society, not least the institution of serfdom. We follow the narrator on his journey to Moscow and witness account after account of atrocities, lawlessness, abuse, and corruption along the way. But in-your-face criticism of the social and political conditions of Tsarist Russia wasn't the most controversial part of the book. Radishev seemed to openly call for the serfs to rebel, and even to emulate Oliver Cromwell's revolutionary zeal.
But you have taught generation after generation how nations can avenge themselves. You had Charles tried in court and executed.
That smelled suspiciously like a call for regicide. Catherine received a copy in late June. Even though she was busy fighting a two-front war with the Swedes and Ottomans, she spent days reading and highlighting controversial passages.
An entire 10 pages were filled up with her comments, and she was not impressed.
The purpose of this book is clear on every page. Its authors, infected and full of the French madness, is trying in every possible way to break down respect for authority and to stir up in the people indignation against their superiors and against the government.
The Tsarina was only 30 pages in when she put the book down and summoned her chief of police to answer WTF he had allowed this book to be published. Probably close to soiling himself, the chief of police had to make an embarrassing confession. He actually hadn't bothered to read the book. Radishev suspected something was wrong and went Fahrenheit 451 on his remaining copies. But on June 30th, he was arrested. The authorities seized and destroyed all copies and banned the book. Radishev was found guilty of insulting the honor of the ruler, of publishing an anonymous libel, and of printing a work without permission from the police. He was sentenced to death by beheading. But in an act of quote-unquote mercy, Catherine changed the sentence to 10 years of exile in Siberia. In fact, the ban wasn't officially lifted until 1868, and even then, copies were still confiscated and destroyed. According to a Radishev biographer, no book in Russia or Europe was so long and so thoroughly suppressed. But what makes journey from St. Petersburg to Moscow interesting from a free speech perspective isn't only the fact that it provoked Catherine to act like an unenlightened despot, or that the book was banned and censored for 78 years. One of the book's less discussed chapters is actually an almost absolutist argument for free speech. The chapter titled Torshak opens with the narrator bumping into a traveler on his way to St. Petersburg. He's on a mission to ask for permission to open a printing office in his hometown. The two engage in a long discussion of censorship, including a brief history going all the way back to ancient Greece. It even references American state constitutions, including a paraphrase of Virginia's Declaration of Rights. Can you guess which part? The freedom of the press is the greatest bulwark of liberty. Yes, that's right. The 18th century's greatest free speech meme had spread from Cato's Letters No. 15 in London, gone viral in the American colonies, and made its way to Russia. Who says freedom of speech doesn't have universal appeal? And to Radishev, Catherine's reforms did not a great bulwark make. He complained that censorship kept the Russian people in a state of perpetual intellectual infancy.
That which may be printed is still under watch and ward. Censorship has become the nursemaid of reason, wit, imagination, of everything great and enlightened. But where there are nurses, there are babies and leading strings, which often lead to crooked legs. Where there are guardians, there are minors and immature minds unable to take care of themselves.
Radishev not only bemoaned the pernicious effects of censorship on reason and learning, his criticism became explicitly political.
In prohibiting freedom of the press, timid governments are not afraid of blasphemy, but of criticism of themselves. He who in moments of madness does not spare God will not in moments of lucidity and reason spare unjust power. The free thinker who has been stirred to his depths will stretch forth his audacious but mighty and fearless arm against the idol of power, will tear off his mask and veil and lay bare its true character.
On the other hand, if government is based on truth and sincere concern for the common good, it has nothing to fear. It will only be strengthened by criticism and...
He whose words incite to revolt is just as much a fool as he who blasphemes God.
In other words, Radishev seems to suggest, much like Madison, that government must suffer stinging and even unfair criticism, and that rulers become unjust and corrupt when they try to silence dissent. Authority must rest on the firm ground of openness and truth, not repression and censorship. But what must have really stung Catherine was Radishev's surgically precise and prophetic indictment of the incompatibility of enlightened despotism and freedom of speech.
What does it profit you to struggle against yourself and to destroy with your left hand what your right hand implanted?
Then followed what may have been an uncomfortably precise psychological profile of Catherine's state of mind.
In whose head can there be more incongruities than in that of a Tsar?
As we shall see later, Radishev's conception of free speech was vastly more radical than the wording of the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, and also went further than where most Enlightenment thinkers would draw the red line. No wonder it stood no chance of appealing to even an enlightened despot like Catherine. But the cruel and vindictive punishment of Radishev was not the end of Catherine's crackdown. She was just getting started. Terrified that the French Revolution would metastasize to Russia, she ordered newspapers not to publish sensitive information. In 1792, it was Novikov's turn to feel the wrath of Catherine. His estate was searched and a number of banned books were found. Dropping all Beccaria's principles of due process, Catherine issued an edict banishing Novikov to 15 years of imprisonment in a fortress. Among his crimes was publishing forbidden, immoral, and anti-orthodox books, and setting up a secret printing press to continue the publication of expressly forbidden books. Even the French philosophes, whose ideas she had once praised and copied, were now seen as dangerous. The fact that the complete works of a philosophe fanboy Voltaire was banned as being harmful and filled with demoralization speaks volumes of Catherine's volte-face. In 1796, a month before she died, Catherine took her last and most decisive step towards shutting down the Enlightenment troll factories that she had once welcomed, encouraged, and supported. She issued a sweeping edict
to put an end to various inconveniences resulting from the free and unrestricted publication of books.
The edict created census offices in major towns. All private printing presses were to be closed. No book was to be written or translated within or imported into the empire without prior licensing. New official and religious printing presses were to be under strict governmental and ecclesiastical control, respectively. Postmasters were to censor periodicals carried through the mail. And all these restrictions were to be strictly enforced by governors and other relevant officials, with legal sanctions to be applied against the offender. No way a new Radishev was to slip through the net. Catherine had been the first ruler in Russian history to formalize freedom of speech and the press. Now, she became the first ruler in Russian history to erect an official and systematic regime of censorship. We may regret Catherine's censorious U-turn and wonder what could have been had she stayed the course and fought to entrench the idea and practice of free speech in Russian culture. But in many ways, the unhappy ending was both predictable and inevitable. As we have seen from its very birth in ancient Athens, freedom of speech has been intimately related to democracy. This connection was reiterated in the Anglo-American tradition from at least the Levellers to James Madison's crystallization of First Amendment principles in his report of 1800. But when imposed from the top down by an absolute ruler, instead of being claimed by a critical mass of the population, freedom of speech rests on clay feet. No absolute ruler can allow her subjects to openly and contemptuously criticize her person and policies, much less advocate for political changes that would depose her. In democracies, sharp differences in political opinion, mobilization of political support, and agitation against politically elected leaders is part of the very DNA. As Madison put it, in a democracy, the people, not the government, possess the absolute sovereignty, and thus restrictions on free speech must
produce universal alarm, because it is leveled against that right of freely examining public characters and measures and of free communication among the people thereon, which has ever been justly deemed the only effectual guardian of every other right.
But such an understanding and practice of free speech is a lethal threat to absolute rulers. So naturally, free speech in enlightened despotism must almost by definition be limited to abstract ideas while shunning controversial political speech. This was what Radishev and Novikov had understood, and when they challenged Catherine to prove them wrong, they essentially called her bluff and forced her hand. But enlightened despotism also suffers from another fatal flaw when it comes to freedom of speech, especially when imposed from the top down on a country with no tradition or culture of free speech. Because without the popular political and cultural entrenchment, all liberal reforms rest on nothing but the goodwill of the absolute ruler, which, as we have seen, may change from one day to the other. And the next absolute ruler in line may be entirely opposed to free speech and do away with all reforms and impose an inquisition at the stroke of a gilded scepter. The next time free speech was formally entrenched in Russian law was in 1905, but only for a brief moment, as both Tsarists and then in brutal and systematic fashion the Bolsheviks engaged in suppression and censorship, lasting until the end of the Cold War. And while Catherine the Great explicitly hailed and adopted European Enlightenment values, Russia's current ruler, Vladimir Putin, recently declared Western-style liberalism for obsolete. But while we wait for Russia to embrace the idea and practice of free speech, we can at least celebrate the rich Russian literary tradition that has given the world writers like Pushkin, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and Solzhenitsyn, despite the fragile state of free expression. Catherine's ill-fated attempt to reconcile freedom of speech and absolute rule should give pause to those in liberal democracies who yearn for more assertive rule by strong and charismatic rulers. But perhaps it should also make democratic leaders in countries currently establishing sophisticated online censorship regimes like Germany, France, and Britain think twice about how far democracies can go in limiting free speech while still remaining liberal. Thanks for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj, and Matthias Meyer provided valuable research. As always, we would love for you to comment, share, and like, and especially to leave a review on iTunes.